Unmuted. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. This one maybe. How far am I getting in here? Well, I just want to try to give you a general picture of Detroit in that area, because as I went back into it, all of these things that came back, I got back right into the days of operating there. All right, the atmosphere in the atmosphere in Detroit at this time, you can get a little sense of it if I tell you that firings were happening all over the city at the big locals. Thompson Products, 35 fire. Detroit Aluminum and Brass, 12 fire. Graham Page local were protesting, 15 being fired. And on down the line, every day in the headlines, you know, walkout, so many workers fired. And then we had a representative by the name of Decker in our state legislature in Michigan who asked for the death penalty for strikers in his bill. And then he wanted also that then the Selective Service was reclassifying strikers to 1A. They had started this illegally, but they wanted a bill to make this part of the procedure, that if you were a striker, you'd get reclassified 1A immediately, while Decker was calling for the death penalty, no less. It was a very, very hot atmosphere at the time, and it was definitely corporation and labor. You could feel it in every street and every avenue of that city. And the corporations by 1945, the spring of early 45, they were looking ahead to the termination of the war, because already you had VE Day. And did you have VE Day? Not yet, no, not yet. You had VE Day. That was in Europe, and they were concentrating on Japan, and they knew that it would be only a short time. So they knew there would be huge cutbacks, and there would be unemployment, and there would be revolutionary ferment among the working class, and they were attempting right off the bat to undermine, to intimidate the union leadership so that they could have better control. And by April, the National Association of Manufacturers and the National Chamber of Commerce attacked the peace charter that was signed by the CIO president, Phil Murray, and Bill Green of the AF-AVL, they had a real campaign launched. No, Bill Green and Phil Murray and the NAM signed the peace charter. And then there were other elements that wouldn't even recognize the very peace charter that they had signed. And the NAM came out with an attack on this. This wasn't enough. They weren't going to recognize any agreements with Bill Green and Phil Murray, who were really labor they were labor representatives, but they were lackeys for the corporations. They were.
What were the elements of the peace charter?
The peace charter was that they would have no labor disturbances, no no strikes, no labor disturbances, no not asking for anything that would be unusual in this period of the peace charter between the corporations and the company. We would work together as one country, one nation, and so on.
It was basically that during this period of demobilization following or towards the end of the war that we would continue with the same effort that had occurred during the war in terms of cooperation between labor and nation.
Yes, yes, yeah. And then conditions got so bad with all of this, the firings and the conflict between labor and management, that the foremen attempted to form a union. Remember, they were in the middle. They were given instructions to ride a guy and fire him, and the union was going back and giving him hell, making his life hell on earth within the department. And he was the middleman. So they wanted a union. They wanted some protection. They couldn't stand it. And this was the first attempt to organize the foreman's union. And this worried the company more than ever. They were going to lose some of their good orderlies, you know. This worried them more than ever.
Was there a foreman's union formed at 3 to 12?
Yes, and that was one of the first, and the union attempted to help the poor foremen. These guys that were just impossible to deal with before, because they were taking strict company positions and taking all of the rebuffs that they got, when they started to organize, they said, well, we think maybe if you had some independence, it would be good for you, and we tried to help them.
Yes. I presume they did not accept the assistance of the UAW.
On the contrary. They were so weak compared to the big UAW, on the contrary, that they were welcoming it. And many of them at this time began to give us little inner secrets and little inner plans of the corporation. And if you mention this, I'll call you a liar. You know, we got that kind of inside information from them.
What ultimately happened with their unit?
I don't think they ever got very far. I never followed that through. They were still making efforts. They may even still be making efforts today. They may have some semblance.
Mm-hmm.
I know they actually gave it a charter at one point. Whether it was successful,
mm-hmm.
I don't know or not. I've never read anything about it. And, you know, many times a union will have, like the old AFL, it will just go on for years and years and never be able to grow or to die or the decent death or anything.
Well, you know, once the firing started, was this primarily an anti-union effort, or was it also an attempt to start the demobilization? Were both of those factors at work, or was it primarily...
They wanted that union broken. They wanted their contract agreements broken. It was a real, genuine, the National Association of Manufacturers, it was nationwide housebreaking and taming of this union. They never accepted it. And this was the ideal time. And when they knew that they were going to have to retool the plants, they decided just to crack down and crush as much of the militant element of those unions that were trying to maintain the independence of the unions, the autonomy of the unions, as they possibly could. So they were firing them wholesale. And then, you see, when they hired them back, if a man was fired, he was blacklisted, and he went into no other plant. The blacklist was a very effective thing back in those days. And if he had then gone through arbitration and reinstated, then he was eligible and had a grievance to be called back to work in that plant or any other plant. But if he was fired and blacklisted, that was the end of that man, and they considered, you know, the great growing numbers of these radical leaders, what they termed radical leaders, was a threat to them in retooling and starting up production for automobiles under the normal economy provisions, where it wouldn't be cost plus, but it would be just getting as much labor production out of labor as they could for profit.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this happening at the same time that the women were being demobilized and the seniority rights were being restored, or were they...
Well, the women weren't being demobilized at this particular juncture in 1945 that we're speaking about yet. They were still in the plant.
Mm-hmm.
When they were demobilized, it came all at once in the summer time, and they let out hundreds of thousands of workers off the plant. And that was something that one who lived through those days could never forget. There were demonstrations of people. There were people who were laid off all at once, filing for unemployment compensation, and these lines would go blocks and blocks. One block was three and four abreast, was 7 blocks long, just standing out in the broiling sun, waiting for to file for unemployment compensation. And do you know what that was in 1945? $20 a week for 20 weeks, and workers forced to this kind of conditions to stand out there in the boiling sun to try to get registered as soon as possible so the benefits could start coming as soon as possible.
Now, by the time the demobilization actually began, was prior to your final firing, wasn't it?
No. No, the demobilization, there may have been in some areas, the big grand one was let loose with the declaration of the war with Japan. And then the plants were all practically evacuated. Everybody was just thrown out in the streets for retooling. Airplane production and tank production is nothing like the automobile production. The whole plant has to be set up differently.
Mm-hmm.
New conveyor belts, the whole retooling, the whole plant in operation.
So I was wondering what the response, if you were still in the plant when many of the women started to be demobilized, what their response was in terms of their own expectations of if they would be...
Oh, we talked about it prior to when we knew it was coming. Yes, of course. And as I say, at the end of their stint in the plants, about 3 years, I would say, when they began coming in great numbers before they were let out, the great percentage of them wanted to continue to work. And somewhere I came across some figures on that also. where they had taken a survey in San Francisco, for instance. 98% of the women were working that were working in that plant were in there because they had nursery and child care. 88% of them depended on it totally. And 98% of them said they expected to live there in that city and they wanted to continue working, but 88% said that they couldn't if the nurseries and the child care centers mm-hmm. were taken away from them. And, of course, they were. And it was a very great hardship. They were hoping that they could continue to form new nurseries, cooperative nurseries, or other arrangements, and that they could go on working. But at this time also, the federal government took away, this was a concerted nationwide program to get women out of those plants, and then the big business of, well, the woman should be in the home, and the demobilization of the armies, and women should be there to greet her husband. The family can be reunited. They weren't concerned about that when they needed their labor. And then the woman was glamorized who went back into her home and built her little nest and perhaps added extra children and so on. And they were treated quite the opposite. And it was a shock to these women who were Rosie the Riveter and who were glamorous young women in overalls and pictures and magazine articles and teachers, and everybody was listening to what they could do and how their government respected them. And all of a sudden, anybody who wanted to demand that she continue in the job, she was no fit woman at all. And the government also then saw no necessity for maintaining these child care centers. And the union leadership was not too concerned about fighting for women's seniority. If a veteran came back and he had no seniority at all, well, he deserved it because he had been overseas fighting, and a woman with 3 years seniority wasn't even considered.
Did the women, princess with seniority, talk about organizing it all around that issue and really fighting?
Well, they talked in wishful terms. It's very hard for women to organize when they don't have elected representatives in an already organized body. It's very difficult for them. They've got the other problems always on their back, like a monkey. The children, their schooling, they must have this. They need a new pair of shoes. They've got to go to communion on Sunday. I have to get them this. And my mother-in-law's coming. And all of the problems men never had to worry about. So the women, unless they've got representatives within a union setup, and they can go to that woman and fight through that woman, they just don't amorphously say, well, let's get together someplace at a tea party or something. And they were talking wishful terms. And they were going to continue. And they were going to make applications. They weren't taken back at this plant. They've had experience. They're going to go here and they're going to go there. For those who did get any jobs at all, the majority of those, usually wound up at much less, you know, waitresses and store clerks and things like that. Most of them were back in the homes by the end of this whole process.
And even though,
and on top of that, they were not even counted as unemployed. Those who designated distinctly that they wanted to be called back were never counted in the ranks of the unemployed. The woman was just a necessary little thing during the war effort to produce bombs to kill people. But when she was not needed anymore, well, then she was not even a figure in the total employment figures that were given out.
Because she wasn't supposed to be looking for work.
That's right. She's not supposed to be looking.
Was she able to collect unemployment insurance, though?
Mm-hmm. She could get the compensation for the 20 weeks in bingo. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So
after that, she was faded back into oblivion.
She had provided them with the nucleus of an organization and some organizing skills.
On the job.
There was no effort to translate that ability into their immediate situation, their own situation, in terms of those who wanted to continue working. For instance, boy, there had been a women caucus formed among those women within the union to force the union to...
No, they didn't have the time. And as I said, Detroit was a very hard city. There were shortages of materials and even of transportation in that city. They had streetcars that I had to ride 1 hour to get to my job when I first went down there until I could get closer to the plant. Streetcars that had coal-burning stoves on them. And we got on a bitter cold morning, and they would huddle up against that stove, and the ones at the far end of the car practically hanging on because there was no room were freezing to death. There was no other heating in that streetcar to get out to the plant. And you could see these old cars were pressed into service, clang-a-clang-a-clang, along with the more modern ones. When they got near the plants, they just disgorged their workers, like ants crawling off. And they're the same thing at night. You waited around. And then for cigarettes, everything was, well, meat was rationed, cigarettes were rationed, and silk stockings and all kinds of things. And people would line up for necessities, or even for cigarettes for that matter. And it was not an easy city, a very difficult city to live in.
By this time, where were you living towards the end of this period, when you were fired and when you were beat up? Were you then living in this
area?
You were no longer in that one room site that you'd been in when you first came to Detroit.
No. We had another little apartment. This is the one where they entered and beat me up, very close to the Mack Avenue Briggs plant.
And where was Saul working at that time?
He was working in the plant next door at Motor Products. And that also was filled with ferment. There wasn't a plant there that didn't have a lot of ferment going on because
he
of conditions.
He wasn't in your local, though.
No, he wasn't. Mm-hmm. At no time. So, then the drive of the corporation, the government, and so on this whole anti-labor. It was really an anti-labor drive. There's no question about it. You couldn't look at it any other way. Culminated in our local by beatings. And at first we didn't know where they came from. We had no idea. But a veteran of World War II who had returned, but who had long been active in the labor movement, an Italian fellow, Joe Vigga, was the first one who was attacked with a lead pipe. And his arm was broken and he was severely beaten on the street.
That was the first beating.
That was on the street with his wife. Getting out of the car, and that was the first one that was done. And then after that, we got another very fine man who personified. He was a sergeant of arms of the local, an Irishman who had come out of the coal mines. He knew Mother Bloor personally. He was a remarkable person. He had been captain of the flying squadron during the days of organization at Briggs Local. And I think they felt that they could get at him and beat him because he wasn't afraid of the devil. He was Mr. Superman himself as far as the people in the local were concerned. And they beat him very, very badly.
Was that Snowden?
Roy Snowden, uh-huh. And as he was going into his apartment building, he bent over to unlock the door, but there was a key broken off in the lock. Rang the doorbell wire had been cut, and he was attacked from behind. And the pattern of the beatings showed us that they were professional. As you know, many workers live hard. They go into beer gardens, and they get into arguments or fighting over somebody's wife or God knows what. But both of these men were beer-drinking men.
Mm-hmm.
But both of these were professional beatings. And what they did was they first put you on the head, knock you on the head to knock you unconscious. If that didn't do it, they hit you on the arm. I got it in the collarbone, but they hit you on the arm so you couldn't reach for a gun, and then on the leg so that you couldn't get up and run after them if you survived the others. And it was done so quickly and so professionally that both of them recognized this as a professional gangster or professional hoodlum who was doing this. And the pattern was so similar. And going after these two very courageous men, we decided in our local that we did believe their story. And we set up an investigating committee. Well, many people felt that this was kind of sticking your neck out maybe for a beating also. And in order to encourage people to serve on the committee, I volunteered and was elected to this committee. And we had some other very fine people heading it up. And one of the officers of our local was on that committee. I think his name was Murphy, and Ernie Macy from 212 was on it also.
And the initial beatings occurred in June of 45?
In May. May. Roy Snowden was told by these people in back of him as they clubbed him, leave Detroit permanently within 24 hours or meet your death, so that we knew by this time that it wasn't just it was something very... So we were involved also in that. I was meeting with that committee, besides, the chief steward's bodies and all the other things that were going on. I was going 24 hours a day, but we were very concerned about that. And we found some information that we took to the International Union, and it turned out to be a very, very damaging thing that we had run upon. It was a scrap contract for scrap metal. Now, this is government scrap. It was sold to the son of a mafia member there by the name of Sam Peroni, the son-in-law, whose name was Carl Renda. And we found that this contract was let out to Carl Renda. And we knew, and the man who told us was in mortal fear of his life about this thing. We knew we had something, but as, you know, novices at this game, we didn't really know what the full import of it was. And we took this information to the International Union. At that time, we asked them to put up a reward to help us prevent any further beatings in the local. And at that time, they said no, they couldn't do that. There were too many beer garden fights and so on. Everybody would come in and want a reward put up.
Oh, so were they discrediting the stories of the beatings?
They were just saying, well, we don't know about it, you go ahead with your investigations. And Roy Brewster, when I said that if we didn't, Walter Ruther, who was vice president of the union at the time, when we spoke to him, and I said, if this isn't stopped, Walter, it may reach up into the International Union, and then that would be a very sad day. And he looked at me, he had known me for many years, and he said, you know, let's not get dramatic about this thing. And the sad story was that later, another form of attack, the shooting of the two Ruther brothers by gun, was traced to the same mafia. The UAW then had an investigation committee for a huge reward. And then following that, several weeks or later in October, they came into my home. And I had not been expecting it at all. For some reason or other, you know, some of these old ideas regarding women creep into your own consciousness. And I kind of thought, why, they wouldn't come in and beat a defenseless woman. A woman out on the streets with a red beret and a club, all right, that's a little bit different. But they wouldn't come into a home and do anything. And I go to work, I come home, what else? I never thought that I would be the one.
You were the only woman on the investigation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And surely enough, they did. They came in the back door of my home. The place had been cased, and they had to come through a very small kitchen area. And I had a flashlight in my eyes, and that's about it. I didn't see anything. It was at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was very dark, and you're sleeping very heavily at that time. And if it hadn't been for my husband being on the other side of the bed and putting his hand over my face, I don't know if I'd be my right mind, because it took me a long, long time to recover from that.
He was awakened by the flashlight?
By the thud beating on me. The thud was a lead pipe. And there was one man standing up against the wall with a what he thought was a gun, you know, and another beating on me. And he put his hand over my head, and he warded off, and he got beaten on the wrist. And then when he went to crawl up over my body, I was unconscious by then, over my body, they clipped him on the legs, so that when he stood up, he fell down immediately. He had been badly beaten on the legs, too, the muscles of the tendons or something.
And
oh, yes, and then they read out, and they had a car parked in the alley. Detroit has alleys in back of their street where you put your garbage and things like that. They ran out in the alley, and a big motor, you know, you could hear a big motor pulling off. He did. And I was paralyzed on one side, and I didn't walk by myself for a long, long time. I was in a cast for 6 weeks in the two different hospitals for, I guess, about 6 weeks or so.
And what injuries did you suffer?
Well, I had brain injury, and I had was not able to, I'd fall down ever so often. Mm-hmm. Something seemed to disturb my balance. I had broken bones, and my face was cut, and I have a paralyzed area left in my face yet today, and I was beaten on the legs, and it was rather bad. In fact, the brain injury sometimes, I often said I would rather be shot next time.
Mm.
It's something that is so painful, so agonizing, it just drives you right out of your mind if you've been had a very serious brain injury sometimes. Terrible pressures in your head.
Now, how did the, not just the unions, but the newspapers too, react to the beating of a woman? That must have found
the union was electrified, and this is when they issued their first statement that the union would put all of its resources into discovering who the perpetrators of such a dastardly crime was. This was the International Union that issued that statement then. The newspapers made it appear, they had a big editorial in the Free Press, made it appear as though this might be some kind of an inter-union fight. You remember we did have the elements for the no-strike pledge and against the no-strike pledge. And they put it, they put a big cartoon that the big union czar was responsible for this beating. And this, of course, incensed the International Union also. It was a terrible thing to have happen. You have a union member beaten so badly, a woman to boot, and then have the newspapers blame the union for it when the union had taken no action previously, either for or against. And so it was a shock. And some of the men in my local union were shaken up as they were never shaken up by Roy Snowden's beating. And my God, if they'll do this to a woman sound asleep in bed at night, what would they do to me? But they asked permission to pack guns, and they went home from union meetings in groups, and they continued to fight. They did a fine job. And of course, they put up another $500 reward in my case for information leading to the apprehension and conviction of the criminal.
What was the resolution of all of this in terms of the beatings and the investigation? Was it just that the union itself uncovered that the mafia was involved, or was that ever made public?
Well, then, by this time, they knew. Then we had another one, you know, Ken Morris. We had all in all six beatings.
Hmm.
One of them was in the interim came and reported he was beaten. We didn't quite ever get the confirmation on that. Ken Morris is now on the International Executive Board, and he was beaten within an inch of his life, too. If his skull had been cracked or just 1 inch further, he would have been a dead man. And then when the Reuters were shot, they were attacked, then they hired a man from the former La Follette Senate Investigating Committee by the name of Ralph Winstead, and they put him out full-time with a full staff, full office, full everything to track this down. And they had what they figured, what they considered as airtight evidence against the mafia, Peroni and Sam Peroni and Carl Renda, his son-in-law. But the witness who was going to give all this information escaped. They had him in a closet someplace between Windsor and Detroit, in a hotel room, rather, and they were guarding him, and he escaped. And shortly after that, Ralph Winstead, who was a fine investigator, who would track down the tiniest little clues, went through the ice in Lake Michigan near his home. And that was never solved. And I think then by then the statute of limitations had run out. And the union to this day, in all of its literature, will say that it was traced to the mafia, but we never had the court compensation nor the claims. We would have had some big, big financial claims, you know, for these beatings and the expenses and so on. The International Union did pay all of my expenses while I was in hospital, but...
So by that time, you finally acknowledged that it was an attempt to break the union.
Oh, yes. And they hired the finest brain specialists and neurosurgeons in the city of Detroit, or, for that matter, they're nationally known.
Mm-hmm.
To take care of my case and Ken Morris and so on, but it was never definitively proved in court.
And the state and the city never in any way pushed any of the investigation themselves.
No.
It was an assault.
My God, there were so many things that they found out afterward that the chief of detectives who came up to interrogate me was so cruel to me. Well, certainly after the beating, my eyes weren't in focus. I couldn't see, and I couldn't think. I was badly injured, and I was still paralyzed. This man came up and was trying to grill me. Where's your first husband? And he's not out of the army. Who have you been fooling around with? And all kinds of nasty questions. And I kept begging with him, please come back. Please come back later. I can answer your questions. And a couple of union men walked in, and the paper, he gave a statement out to the paper that I clammed up as soon as these two union representatives came into the room. This man, this cruel, cruel man, I never forget his name because he was a Frenchman by the name of de la Meilleur. It was discovered late and proved that a whole beer garden or nightclub setup had been given over to the name of his wife, and it came directly from the Sanfilippo family. And so this is, he was bought off and paid off right within the police department. So it was, there were days fraught with much danger in living in that period, you know, if you want to stand up to your rights.
Now, you know, by the time of your beating, you actually had been fired. You were no longer working in the plant, were you? Weren't you fired in August or so, and the beating had taken place in October?
Mm-hmm.
So the investigation started, and then somewhere in there was when the firing occurred.
Yes, I was fired just before I had a grievance pending, and then there's the plant. That's right. The plant shut down and let out all of the workers. That's true.
Now, you were fired as part of the big, as the large group that was fired then, rather than being a specific attack on
you. Yes. This is when 18,000 workers in the city of Detroit and the Breed Local and the Chrysler and several people, locals, were. It was going across the nation by the way. But we were under a constant attack by Briggs Corporation. And the superintendent, had a great deal of admiration and respect for me. An old white-haired guy by the name of Peter Marshall. And he had known that the pink slip came down on me, and I was accused of everything except raping my grandmother. That was crazy. He had known in the morning, and he called me into his office, and he said, Genora, I have a picture of a Boeing B-27, I think it was, he had there. And I'd like to have you autograph it, and I'd like to have several of the other people in the department autograph it. He said, I've already had the foreman out, and they've got some autographs, but I want yours. And I said, you don't want mine. He said, yeah, I'm going to hang it up on my wall to remember these days. And he said, I'd like yours right on the nose, right on the propeller. And I said, look, that would only give you, I thought he was getting a little soft in the head, that would only give you a headache, Marshall, to remember these things later on. I don't think you need my signature. Yes, well, before he called me into the office, I said, wait a minute, I'll get my steward. I never went into an office at this, I never did anyway, without a witness. I learned that early in the game. You always have your witness with you. So my steward was here. We were both nonplussed. Why would he want my signature? Of all the people in the world, why would he want mine? And I looked at him, and he had such a benign smile on his face. And I thought, well, hell, this can't hurt anything. I put my name right on the propeller of the plane, and my steward signed it, and we walked out, and I said, Jesus, is he getting soft in the head or what? And we knew that the war was coming to winding down and so on. And he had a big reputation as a superintendent, you know, and he dealt with the Army, the Navy, and everybody else. And then a little later on, the word came down that I'm wanted up in the plant manager's office at the end of the shift. And so I went up to the plant manager, and by this time, two or three other chief stewards came running to me. Did you get your pink slip yet? And I said, what pink slip? You know, did you get it? We got it served to us. No, they want to give it to me up in the plant manager's office. In fact, I guess the superintendent didn't want to give it to me. And so he knew about this, and I went up there, and I was fired. And they said, now you don't need to bother to clock out. You don't need to.
Did you know what they told you at the firing? Just that they were laying off people?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. These are the reasons. And right on the pink slip, I was charged with leading and fomenting and agitating and revolutionizing workers. And I can't tell you what that thing, but I was surprised. I said, you forgot raping my grandmother, you know. And you don't need to go back down to your department. Now, remember, I was first shift. Second shift was coming in, and this was at the end of the first shift. They wanted to get me the hell out of that plant. And they assigned one of the plant guards to take me out of the plant, to escort me out of the plant. We were in the middle of the plant. There was an entrance here, the Canfield entrance. It would be a short distance. No, I was going out to the Mack Avenue entrance, the long way, half the plant. And I was going to clock out my time clock. He said, we'll check it out for you. I said, by now I don't trust you guys. After this slip, I don't trust you at all. I'm going to clock out my own card. And I have possessions in that plant, in that department, and I plan to pick up my own belongings. And so this great big huge giant of a man, he was the biggest man you could possibly imagine. I think he was 7 feet tall and broad like a barn door. he looked down at me like, well, what do you do if you say you're going to do it? You can't, you know, pick her up and carry her out. And so they said, you will escort her out of the plant. She's no longer employed here. I said, after we stopped at Department 15. And I had already left two of my stewards down there and said, you stay here until I come back. Don't leave. And they were there to get the word to carry into the second shift of Department 15. And I clocked out. I picked up my belongings. And then I told him, I'm not going out the Canfield entrance. I'm going out the Mack Avenue entrance the long way. And I took my time clocking, took my time in picking up all my things and conferring with my stewards. And the whole department was there. The superintendent wasn't there. General foreman, the assistant general foreman, none of them. They couldn't bear to face me, I guess. I don't know. There. And the stewards were wondering about that also. Well, it was all cleared out. And then as I took my time, the second shift workers were coming in, beginning to clock in, and they were coming in droves. And little by little, we walked up very slowly, and I'd stop and talk to every chief steward coming in. They fired six of us today, seven of us, I guess. I don't know the figures that I got. Every so often the figures go up. And so immediately contact the local union. We're going over there now to map out the strategy. Contact your local union. And all the way out, I had notified everybody, and this great, and I said, and this is my escort. Isn't he a nice-looking young man? Isn't he, and he's so small, you know, and making fun of him, and he didn't know what in the hell to do with me. He couldn't do anything, you know, and the workers were just, all right, we got the word, and they'd look up at him, we got it, you know, and then we went over to local union. Of course, they pulled all of the rest of the plants in Briggs. And they notified the International Union and so on and so forth.
But none of you were reinstated?
None of us were reinstated. Our cases were all pending. Mm-hmm.
So they left after the plant was closed. They then allowed people to go back pending an investigation of your cases. Is that it? Why would they have gone back after the plant was closed without having your demands met?
This was an arbitration. You know what the empire system is. I've gone through that a couple times already in Briggs, and it was an arbitration. Okay. So then I went after that. Now, let me see. When did the in September? When I went into a cotton plant after that. Oh, no. Then I went into the Frankenstein for Mayor campaign. The Political Action Committee of the International Union decided that the Detroit city government, all of it, had been so pro-corporation, so anti-union, that they needed to put up their own candidate. This is the first time in the history of that union. So Dick Frankenstein, who came out of the Chrysler setup, I think, or Dodge, anyway, he was put up as a candidate. He was an International Executive Board member, and he was a very powerful man, personality, and so on. We were also running three candidates for the Common Council of the City of Detroit. And so I was taken over. I was going to go on a paid basis working in that campaign. I think I worked 2 or 3 days. We're just beginning to get the thing together. When I was beaten up.
Oh, I see.
So at that point, I was not in the plant. I was working on the mayoralty campaign of the UAW, and I was beaten up. So I was not with the girls when they were actually released from the plant.
Right. So then after your firing from Briggs, was that the last time you worked in the shop then?
Well, I tried to stay on in Detroit. I knew that I was blacklisted. I knew that. And so I got into a little tiny cotton factory, and my God, what a speed up, what a killer it was. It would be a factory that would produce bats and rolls and all kinds of cotton formations for upholstery for cars. But this cotton dust constantly, and my one lung, I was just going downhill very, very fast. I think I must have been in that maybe 3 or 4 months, and I just couldn't stand it. So I all went to Flint in the meantime. Was staying with my parents, and then finally we went up into Flint, moved to Flint with the two boys and so on. Uh-huh.
Now, do you have more union stuff there? I was just wondering if this would be a good...
All right. In this election for the mayoralty campaign, that Dick Frankenstein, 2016, there was a new high for registrations in the Detroit municipal elections, which scared the wits out of the companies, you know, the corporations. They never had such a high rate of registration. And the General Motors head, Charles Wilson, issued a statement: at this time, for the 48-hour week at straight time, where the union was asking for a 30% increase in wages to make up for their lost frozen wages, he said that he advocated the pay raise of only 5 to 8%. And this was following a meeting with President Truman just the day before. He issued this. Can you imagine how this set with workers? They'd fought so hard to win the 40-hour week. And then he comes back and he says, now we're going to have a 48-hour week. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was Frankenstein a socialist? Has he been with the Social Party of the SPD?
No, no. Yeah, he was a straight union man. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. He issued a statement on my beatings, too, and said that this was a campaign, a newspaper campaign, this article I told you about in the Free Press, as a lynch incitement against organized labor, coupled with an attempt to foment discord in labor's ranks. And then the International Union set up an investigating committee for the first time. And they had failed to act in the earlier assaults, but on this one they decided to set up the investigating committee and to undertake a vigorous investigation and post a $5,000 reward for information. And this is the first time that Walter Reuther stated that, remember he had told me before not to be dramatic, and then when I'm lying in a hospital bed, he said that the resources of our whole union will now be thrown into the fight against these hoodlums. So I had that satisfaction anyway, and his mind was changed. Okay, I think that would be a good idea.